Okay, Steve. Please. Yeah. Right over here. Yeah, anywhere. Yeah, that's good. Good evening, everyone. I think we'll get started. We have a few people trickling in and finding their seats. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all to the third of our four public forums for this 2016-2017 session. And the theme of the four lectures is today's research for tomorrow's cure. But this evening, we've sort of taken a departure from our normal format, where we have basic researchers and clinician scientists discussing recent developments in the lab and how that impacts treatment and on a sort of a cancer-specific focus. We've taken a little bit of a different track tonight, and we have three investigators, either fundamental scientists or clinician scientists, that will speak about three different diseases, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and pancreatic cancer. But coupled with those presentations, we will have a scientist who is also, or has been, a patient that was dealing with that particular disease. So we thought it would be interesting to have a perspective of a patient who is going through a cancer diagnosis, but also an individual that's a scientist that knows a significant amount about the disease. So there's one housekeeping note that I wanted to make note of. We have photographers that are circulating around the auditorium this evening, and they'll be taking pictures. If you have, if you don't want your picture to be taken, if you could just maybe move off to the right side of the auditorium so that you're sitting there, so that we know that when pictures are being taken, we'll avoid snapping your image if you're opposed to that. So for any of you that don't wish to have their pictures taken, please just move over to the right side. Okay. So my name is Peter Siegel. I'm a scientist here at the Goodman Cancer Center. My laboratory is located on the fifth floor of the Goodman Pavilion. And I'm also currently serving as associate director for the Cancer Center, and I'll be the facilitator for the first part of tonight's session. And so it gives me great pleasure to introduce the first speaker for this evening's session, which is Dr. Morag Park. Dr. Park is a professor in the departments of oncology and biochemistry, and she's currently the acting director of the Goodman Cancer Center. She's a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and a James McGill professor, and she also holds the Diane and Sal Guerrera Chair in Cancer Genetics here at McGill University. Dr. Park joined McGill in 1988 and has directed a research program that really is focused on understanding the molecular mechanisms that drive breast cancer progression and therapeutic response. She's well known for her work in the field of receptor tyrosine kinases and how these particular proteins are activated and how those receptors drive breast cancer initiation, progression, and response to treatment. Most recently, her work has taken her into the domain of the tumor microenvironment and understanding how breast cancer cells interact with non-cancerous cells within the local microenvironment and how that shapes tumor growth and progression. So I'm pleased to welcome Morag to the podium, and she'll give us an overview of breast cancer then and now.
So thanks very much, Peter, and thank you everybody for coming here tonight. I realize it's a miserable evening outside. We have had these sessions in snowstorms and in the seventh game of the Montreal Canadiens, so we have survived, so we just keep our fingers crossed for tomorrow night. So I'm the first speaker, and this is a little bit about a journey in a way that we made together with Nicole. And this goes back to 2001, when I was starting a breast cancer research program at the same time that Nicole was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so the then and now is really a little bit of a highlight of what we knew then And some of the new directions that we understand from a research perspective, but how these have translated into the clinic in the last 17 years. So I don't have a pointer. Okay. So what we've known for a long time now is that breast cancer is the most frequent form of cancer in women. So this is excluding skin cancer, for example. And it's the second most common cause of cancer death in women. We now know that 1 in 9 women in North America will be diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetime. But we also know it's not just one disease. So all breast cancer is not the same. When you're diagnosed with breast cancer, it's frequently identified now through mammography. And once the tissue is removed or a biopsy is taken, it will be stained in the pathology. It will be fixed and stained, and you'll get these nice pictures. But you will identify whether this is a cancer or a normal growth, for example. The important thing at this stage is it's difficult to tell the difference between different breast cancers. And so one of the most important things that we've identified is the use of different tools to identify different subtypes of breast cancer. So what we knew 17 years ago when Nicole was diagnosed was that there was a subtype of breast cancer that was positive for the estrogen receptor. This is the most common breast cancer in women. About 70% of women will have breast cancer of this type.
Excuse me, when you turn around, we can't hear
you. You can't hear me. So it's going to be difficult to point and speak. Oh, use the arrow on the screen. Okay, I need to put my glasses on then. Sorry about that, folks. Can anybody work an arrow on a... Oh, here we go. Got it. Okay. So 17 years ago, what we knew was that the most common form of breast cancer was positive for the estrogen receptor. So it's called ER, estrogen receptor positive. Sometimes it'll be positive for the progesterone receptor. But you can identify these cancers, importantly, in the clinic, this is in clinical diagnosis, by staining the tissue for the estrogen receptor. And this is the type of picture you get if you do that. Here we go. And the important thing is you can treat these patients with tamoxifen. This is a drug that will block the function of the estrogen receptor. Frequently, though, these women will also be treated with chemotherapy and radiation. And that was the state 17 years ago when Nicole was diagnosed. At the same time, what we've understood is that there's another subtype of breast cancer called HER2-positive. This was identified about 20 years ago. We can identify it again by a test in the clinic. This is in the clinical diagnosis labs where you will stain for the HER2 receptor. There are now treatments for this subtype of breast cancer, but at the time that Nicole was diagnosed, that wasn't the case. This has occurred in the last 17 years. The third type of breast cancer is called triple negative. This is negative for the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and the HER2 receptor. This one is actually more difficult to treat. It's still treated with chemotherapy and radiation. And these patients are called triple negative disease, and that's about 15% of all breast cancers. So HER2 is an example of what we call personalized medicine. So the HER2 receptor, this is the HER2-positive breast cancer that I just showed you in the previous slide. This thing in me doesn't. Okay, here we go. The HER2-positive breast cancer. This is a breast cancer that's not HER2-positive. So you can see the difference. And this would be the difference that you could recognize that the pathologists in the clinic and the clinical diagnosis would see. This just shows you the trajectory of the understanding of HER2-positive breast cancer. So this was first made by a discovery, a basic science, cloning of the HER2 receptor. It was then pioneered by clinicians who identified that this receptor was amplified in some breast cancers. But one of the most important demonstrations was the building of a preclinical animal model. And this was demonstrating that HER2 causes breast cancer. And this was actually performed by Bill Mueller, who's now at the Goodman Cancer Center, but he did this when he was a postdoc in the United States. By the 1990s, I'll have to try and speak and point at the same time. By the 1990s, what people had understood by research is that you could block this receptor. This is a protein that's on the cell surface. So you could engineer an antibody that would block the function, and this is now called Herceptin. And by the mid-1990s, the first antibodies were developed, FDA approval by the late 1990s. So this is nearly 20 years before this became approved. And now Herceptin is available and approved by the healthcare in Canada around about 2005. Different provinces approved this at different stages. Now, before 2005, you could be enrolled in clinical trials and be treated with Herceptin, but that was through a clinical trial. Nowadays, in addition to staining for that receptor, the clinic will also perform what's called a FISH test. And again, this is just to compare between a non-positive sample and a positive sample. And the importance of these tests are that these are called companion diagnostics. And so for someone to be treated with Herceptin, you would need to be positive by these companion diagnostics. And it's that criteria that allows the healthcare system to pay for that drug to treat you in the clinic. So using, you know, the current, so by now we're around about 2005, that, you know, you can be identify these patients, you can treat them in the clinic, but there's still challenges that were left. And those challenges were that we knew that some of these women wouldn't respond to tamoxifen or they wouldn't respond to Herceptin, and we were still stuck trying to understand how to treat women with triple negative disease. So there was a transformation about 15 years ago, and this transformation was the use of what's called genomic technologies, or big data, as they call it now. And this transformation was really based on the ability to bank tissues, not just to fix a tumor tissue as it's removed from the patient in pathology, but to bank these tissues as frozen tissues with all the clinical information and really carefully handling the quality of the tissue. So we started a tissue bank at the MUHC at McGill for breast cancer, where we have all the clinical data, everything is entered into the database, and we bank the breast tissue. And that means that we can study it. We can ask questions about outcome of patients and begin to understand why some patients respond and why some patients don't respond. Now, at that time, what became apparent that you can use this frozen tissue to ask questions about the detailed changes that occur within cancers. And this is just showing you breast cancer. And basically, this is a snapshot of the changes that you see when that tumor is removed from the patient. And what this began to show us was, again, they identified the four different types. So we've got HER2 amplified in purple. The red is triple negative. It's called basal here, but it's the same thing. What this showed us was that if you look at the patterns of these tumors look different from these tumors, but these are both estrogen receptor positive. So it split the estrogen receptor positive patients into two subgroups. One is called luminal A, and one is called luminal B. They're both ER positive. But we now know that the luminal A subgroup has a better outcome than the luminal B subgroup. So this started a whole new era in how to think about predicting outcome and how to treat cancer patients. And that era is based on using these genomic technologies to use as tools to begin to predict either drug sensitivity or disease progression. And those people who follow the breast cancer field will probably have heard of terms such as Oncotype DX. This is a subset of genes, or what's called a signature, that's now is supported by the healthcare system in Canada. And this signature is to predict for the luminal patients, so the estrogen receptor positive patients early stage disease, which patients would actually do well without chemo versus those patients that would require chemotherapy. So this is actually one of the first decision-making tools that's been implemented into the clinic where the decision is actually not to treat the patient with chemotherapy. So this is a whole new era in decision-making, and this is a tool that aids the clinicians to make that decision. There's another type of tool that's also available. Again, it's based on gene signatures called MammaPrint. This has just come out of large clinical trials. These clinical trials have been going on for 5 years now. It's also a decision-making tool, again, to decide or to identify which patients are most likely to relapse versus those that are most likely to respond well to chemotherapy. So these tools have just come in the last 5 or 6 years that can be used in the clinic, but it really is a game changer on how we think about stratifying patients for treatment in the clinic today. So if we come back to this subtype called triple negative, we still don't have a specific therapeutic approach for these patients. So what we now know is that the majority of patients that have familial associated breast cancer, so of alterations in the BRCA1 or BRCA2 genes, this is about 3% of all breast cancers. Most of these fall into this triple negative subtype. And there are some new therapies that are being tested in clinical trials at the moment that will specifically target BRCA1 patients and BRCA2 patients. But these are not yet FDA approved for treatment in the clinic. One of the new directions that we are clearly beginning to think about from breast cancer, and this is happening now as we speak, is the use of immune therapies. We've had a session one evening on immunotherapies in one of the forums. So this is also being tested for breast cancer. What we know is that some tumors are what we call immunogenic. That means that we are eliciting an immune response against the tumor. And this is the best scenario. However, once we elicit an immune response, what we already know is that the tumor cells themselves can begin to express a molecule that will suppress the immune system. And so these immune cells become what's called exhausted. And immunotherapy is a mechanism to block the suppression of the immune cells such that they can become reactivated again and attack the tumor. But the important thing is not all tumors are immunogenic. So some tumors do not elicit an immune response. So the big challenge that we have at the moment is identifying which patients would respond well to immune therapies and which patients would not respond well. And those patients that would respond, how can we stimulate their immune system? So where we're at now is an understanding that in breast cancer, the HER2 subtype of breast cancer and the triple negative subtype are the two subtypes that stimulate an immune response. So the luminal or ER positive subtype has less of an immune response. So what is predicted is that these two subtypes could benefit from immune checkpoint therapies. But at the moment, we still don't know which patients would respond to immune checkpoint therapies. So these are the types of things that we're studying in my lab at the moment. And what I'm showing here are these brown dots are the immune cells that are fully infiltrated into the tumor. This is a triple negative breast cancer, and it's full of immune cells. And this patient, the patients in that subgroup that look like that have the best response to chemotherapy. We can find other patients where there's no brown dots, so no immune cells present within the tumor. And what we find, if we look at the tissue, this is the tumor tissue removed from that patient. All the immune cells, all these brown dots, are stuck at the outside. So for some reason, the immune cells in that patient are not entering into the tumor. So the challenge that we're facing just now is how can we stimulate these immune cells to enter the tumor? And how can we stimulate them to recognize that tumor and attack that cancer? So these are the challenges that are in the field, and these are the patients that have the worst outcome in response to chemotherapy at 5 years. Just like in real estate, location matters. So we've set up what's called an immunophenotyping platform at the Goodman Cancer Center. And this immunophenotyping platform allows us to identify many different immune cells with different colors. So each of these colors is a different cell type. And what this is, these are the tumor cells, and you can see the immune cells walking through the tumor in this patient. So this is a patient that had one of the best outcomes. So these are the challenges that we're facing now, and this is the direction that we're trying to go. The next steps, of course, is to identify biomarkers. So I told you that we had estrogen receptor to decide to treat with tamoxifen, HER2 receptor to decide to treat with Herceptin. Now we need to identify biomarkers to identify those cancers that would respond to immune checkpoint therapies. So that's really where the field is at the moment. We're working on biomarkers, and so is many people in the world. These types of studies are worldwide. The reason that we can understand what we understand now is because thousands and thousands of breast cancers have been characterized in the same way. This is called big data and sharing big data. People share their data on the web. This has no patient information, but it allows many research groups to study other data. We're now at a stage of identifying new checkpoint targets. So I would say in the next 5 years, what you will see in breast cancer in particular is the identification of patients that would respond to checkpoint therapy, immune checkpoint therapy, and how to identify them in the clinic. The most important thing for us is that this is never me that does the work. I have a huge team of individuals. Tina Grusso and Matt Chigu have done a lot of the work on studying the immune cells. What's important for us is to build funding, obviously, for these types of projects. And one of the biggest challenges in this type of research at the moment is to identify funding to bank tissue, because none of this work is feasible without our ability to bank tissue and without you, the patients, agreeing to have tissue banked. So this is a very important area, also to enroll in clinical trials. This is how new discoveries are made and new advances can bring us to the next step. So thanks very much.
So I'll ask everyone to hold their questions till the end. We'll ask all of our speakers to come up and sit at the table, and then we can open the floor for any questions that you might have, and we can direct those to the appropriate speaker. You should have been given paper and pencils to jot down your questions. We'll collect those at the end of the talks, and we can give those questions to the speakers. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Nicole Beauchemin. Many of you will know Nicole as the regular facilitator of the Goodman Public Forums. But Nicole is a professor in the departments of biochemistry, medicine, and oncology here at McGill, and she's a full member of the Goodman Cancer Center. She's been recognized for 17 years as a scholar of the FRQS, a funding agency here in Quebec. She initiated her independent research program here at McGill in 1988, and her research is focused on the role of CEACAM proteins in colorectal cancer progression, metastasis, and response to treatment. Nicole was diagnosed in 2001 with breast cancer, and she's been in remission ever since, and she's here to share her thoughts on perspective from both sides of the fence. Nicole.
So I'm the only scientist that doesn't have slides tonight. Can you believe this? I've sort of separated my talks in sort of three parts, first of which is I'll tell you a little bit how this happened. I had been going for regular mammographies. I mean, I was very, very diligent in going every year. That year, I was busy. I almost did not go. I remember it was a beautiful Thursday afternoon where I finally kicked myself out of my office, left a mess, made it down to the clinic, knowing very well I would probably be there for 3 to 4 hours waiting to get the mammography and waiting to see the clinician who was interpreting all of this. And when I did get there, the first indication that something might be wrong was the fact that they did not one but two mammographies. Brought me back and did a second one. Technician who did this was very thorough, and to this day, I still remember her. She saved my life. Had I not gone that year and waited one extra year, I would not be here today. I fell into the category of the 70% ER positive, PR positive, but that took 3 weeks after they took a small sample of my tumor to analyze. I was mainly specializing in colorectal cancer. What did I know about breast cancer other than the seminars that we have? So in 3 weeks, I did what any scientist would have done. You go to the internet and you learn everything you wanted to know about breast cancer in the hope that you will understand what the clinician will tell you, and that you'll be able to monitor your case much better than they will, and that you'll understand what treatments they're going to tell you. In retrospect, that was really bad. It created more anxiety than I actually needed. I did learn a lot about breast cancer and got to understand most of the seminars in the last 16 years. When the answer came back, it was a shock. Why would I have breast cancer? There's no cancer in my family, or at least not much. Certainly no breast cancer. There was no reason. Well, there was all sorts of good reasons in the world. I wasn't exercising enough except my fingers on the computer. I was eating very well, but I was also on estrogen replacement therapy for something like 15 years, so that did not help. And so I was told I had to go through a lumpectomy, which is essentially taking out the primary tumor, just a small section of your breast goes with it. Once that was out, what I was most worried about after learning about breast cancer for 3 weeks was it going to be metastatic? Has it disseminated already? Because that was really my greatest worry, was that if it's just a primary, you cut it out, you get some chemo, and you eventually come back and you're okay. If it's disseminated, it's a totally different disease. It's much more aggressive. It's very difficult to treat. And so I consented to be on a clinical trial where which was totally new at the time, which was to find what are called the sentinel nodes. So these are areas around the breast where you have very tiny, tiny, you can't see them with your eye, and they're tiny lymph nodes, and if the primary tumor cells have escaped, they'll lodge into these sentinel nodes. And the idea was, okay, so we have to find them first to be able to analyze them and see whether you've got primary tumors in there or primary cells in there. And so what they do is they inject you with radioactive material and they trace it with a monitor just to find them, and then they take them out and analyze them. They all came back negative, so that was like, yes, it's not metastatic at this point. It's just primary. It's just, we'll go through the treatments and it shouldn't be too bad. Chemotherapy. So I was teaching about chemotherapy, how it's systemically administered and how the patient will have all sorts of side effects. DNA repair mechanisms will kick in. So, you know, as a professor, you're standing right here in this auditorium teaching 250 kids about the wonders of the new cancer therapies. When you're sticking out your arm and they're going to put this magic juice into you, you realize it's poison. You're going to be poisoning your tumor cells. Yes, great, we'll get rid of those. What about the rest of them, the ones that are still normal? So you lose your hair. It was autumn. It was cold. It's cold without hair. I had a nice beret, which I threw out last week. You have all sorts of side effects, gastrointestinal side effects. That was no fun. you eventually sort of go through these treatments and you recover from chemotherapy in reasonable amount of time. But then you go through radiotherapy, which I thought was going to be rather easy. My greatest worry about radiotherapy was I was going to have to do this during the Christmas season. Was there going to be a snowstorm? Would I be able to go up to the general without sliding down those hills and killing myself in the process? In the end, there was no snowstorm till December 28, my last day of radiotherapy. The side effects of radiotherapy lasted for me 2.5 years before it came back to normal. I was so tired. I mean, I was doing half days working here, wondering why I couldn't do full days, just because my whole body had just essentially been totally whacked out of perspective, I guess. So it's been 16 years, and I think the treatments have worked, although I'm still teaching, well, to some degree, graduate students now, where we teach them about tumor heterogeneity. So this is a scientific term that means essentially in a tumor, not all tumor cells are equal. Some are more equal than others. Some will essentially be eliminated, no problem. But some still survive. So the idea as a scientist that still remains and that still comes up for me is there could be a few still floating around here. And I could still come down with metastatic disease. Yes, it's been 16 years. But we've had colleagues that made it to 17 years and came down with metastatic disease and that are no longer with us. So you constantly live with the threat of the disease coming back, yet you see these great new advances of the infiltrating tumor, the infiltrating immune cells and how you can get diagnosed and the immunotherapies that are now coming up. Does it give me hope? Yeah. If I get metastatic disease, I know I'm going to be in for a really tough time, but I know there are new treatments that I didn't have in the first round that should work again. So what has this changed in my perspective as a scientist and from my perspective as a patient? I think two things. As a person, never, ever consider that if you are very, very tired or if you're feeling pain, that it's going to go away on its own. Get a checkup. It saved my life. Exercise. I am running. They keep on running after me. I am eating well. I'm keeping my head most of the time straight, doing fun things, enjoying life, because life is what matters. It doesn't matter how long it is. It matters every day that you are positive about yourself and positive about the people around you and want to do some great things with them. Prevention is really key. Personalized medicine is here. It's going to be helping us. The focus of my research has changed. I was working on primary colon cancer, and it took almost 6-7 years, but I eventually switched the focus of my research to metastatic colorectal cancer, and I've been working with Peter Latrakos, whom you're going to hear next. It's more of a, not that primary colon cancer is all solved. We do have great therapies that, you know, will cure some patients and will prolong those that are very advanced. I was diagnosed at a very early stage, which is called 1C. So this is like one of the earliest stage. I was fortunate enough to be surrounded by great family, my brothers, my sister-in-laws, my nephews and nieces, my husband who had lost his first wife to metastatic breast cancer. So it was really rough for him. We're still together. We're moving together after 16 years being apart. He's on Côte-Nord and I'm here. Great friends, great colleagues in the center, And most of all, the enchantment of discovery and the quest for new ideas and new treatments, and to be doing this with a great bunch of people in a center that is supportive of us as scientists, but us as people and patients. Thank you. So I come back now with a different hat, and I'm becoming the moderator again, I think. So now we switch cancer types. We're going down from the breast to the colon. The next person who's going to be speaking to us is Dr. Peter Matrakos, who is a clinician and a professor of surgery, an associate professor in anatomy and cell biology here at McGill University. He's the director of the multi-organ transplant program and the, listen to this, director of hepatopancreatobiliary surgery. Huh? So he's never quite sure what he's transplanting, I guess it means. And he's at the McGill University Health Center at the Glenn site. He runs a high-volume transplant program with clinical research, and he also has a great lab of people, full of people who are working on liver metastasis. Peter, why don't you come and tell us all about it? Do you want this?
Yeah, I think that is this. I have a lot of difficulty staying in one place, so yeah. This mic would help.
Is it on?
Anybody on? Do these things work? I'll take that. Yes.
Hello?
Everybody hear me?
Great, thanks. You have to come here.
Okay, you are this one?
No, try. No, it's not that one. Yeah, try that one. Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Oh, don't go.
Okay. It should be. Oops.
All right, that's good.
Okay.
Okay, good.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak to you. I will be talking about colorectal cancer, but my focus will be on the liver issue. Not that, Nicole pointed out, not that the primary cancer isn't important, but in many, many instances, we are able to deal with the primary by surgical excision, and in some cases giving adjuvant chemotherapy or giving chemotherapy after removing the tumor to try and prevent liver metastasis that occur. So we'll introduce sort of colon cancer, liver metastasis, and just give you a little bit of background on that. I'll focus a little bit on liver resections and the outcomes that we see in these patients, because ultimately, if we can, we would like to remove these tumors surgically from the liver. And it's one of the few tumor types where you can have stage 4 disease and you have the potential for a cure through a surgical intervention. And then, since this is important, we'll look at taking advantage of some of the properties that the liver has to convert patients that are initially unresectable to a state that we may be able to operate on them. And then we'll talk about what we do for patients that we can't achieve surgical resection for, And also just a few slides on some of the research that, that we're working with, in fact, in conjunction with everybody here, more or less. So it's the third most common cancer in the Western world. It's also the second most lethal cancer after lung cancer. I'm sure George is going to compete for that spot when he gives his talk in terms of the lethality, but either way, it's a very important cancer. 25 Canadians die each day from colon cancer in Canada. So, and the liver is the most common metastatic site. So at the end of the day, for most of our patients, the rate-limiting step in their survival and potential for a cure is what we can do for the 50% of the patients that develop liver metastasis from this disease. So I guess I should have said, if anybody's squeamish, to turn their heads, but this is a real liver. It's actually a really good-looking organ, I believe. It's reddish-brown. It's smooth. It's got sharp edges when it's healthy. This is your gallbladder, by the way. If anybody's had it removed, it has to be taken off the liver. Unfortunately, if you lift this part of the left liver up, you'll see that there is a metastasis there. And you can see it kind of distorts the liver, and it doesn't look as healthy anymore. Anyway, in this particular patient, we were able to remove that tumor. We talk a little bit more about the liver. it doesn't look like there's a lot of anatomy on the liver when you look at it on the surface, like other organs. But in fact, it's very rich in anatomy. In fact, has eight sectors, and actually each of these sections is a little liver on its own. It's got its own bile duct. It's got its own portal vein, its own artery, and in fact could kind of work on its own if you were to cut out everything else. And the other unique thing about this liver, about the liver, is that it has two inflows for blood. So most organs have an artery that brings blood to the organ, and they have veins that take blood away from the organ. The liver does have veins that take blood away from the organ, called the hepatic veins. But it also has a portal vein, and it has a hepatic artery that bring blood to the liver. The portal vein, in fact, brings 80% of the blood to the liver. And you'll see that it is important as we kind of trek through how we're going to treat patients that there's a dual blood supply. You'll see as we talk about it. The other sort of amazing and unique aspect of the liver is that it can regenerate. So if I cut out 60% of your liver, within a number of weeks, you will have plus or minus 10% of the original volume of that liver growing back. Now, it won't look the same, but the volume and the ability for its function will be there. And the other thing is that if you look at the textbooks, you only need 20% of your liver to survive. Now, we shoot for 30% when we're doing surgery, because there are other issues. It has to be good quality liver, obviously. We don't all have good quality livers. There's age factors. There's if there's a lot of fat content in the liver, if you've received chemotherapy before, all these factors are taken into place when we calculate how much liver we can leave you with. So if we go back to the, and we look at cohorts of patients from the 1970s, that were treated for colon cancer liver metastasis, you'll see that if they did not receive surgery, no one survives to 5 years. Whereas if they do receive surgery, we were obtaining about 25% 5-year survivals at that time. The chemotherapy that we had was very rudimentary. We have a lot better chemotherapy now, so we can do better. And you'll see on the next slide, what I've done here is I've gone to the last decade, and I've taken from the literature series of patients that have been reported that have had liver resections for colon cancer, liver metastasis, and I've kind of tabulated the 5-year survival rates, and you can see they go from 33 to 58%, and that probably reflects how aggressive or how adventurous that particular program is. You know, if you highly select your patients, you'll have a higher five-year survival, and if you're less selective, you'll have a lower five-year survival. But if you average them out, they're in the 45% range at this time. And that's what we can expect to achieve in patients with a stage 4 cancer. I mean, I want to emphasize that because it's a little different than some other tumors that are there. Unfortunately, only 80% of patients are not candidates for surgery, either because they have disease outside the liver also, or because whatever type of sort of surgical approach we take, we can't leave them with enough liver for them to survive the immediate postoperative period. Like I said, the liver will regenerate, but nonetheless, we need to have a certain amount of function for patients to survive post-surgical intervention. So we have developed some strategies where we can convert a patient from a unresectable state to a resectable state. So taking a patient that we cannot offer surgery to taking them to a place where we could offer surgery to. So the liver that we leave behind, we call the future liver remnant. And we need to have an adequate future liver remnant. So it has to be enough to support life. And there are some strategies that we've developed to do that in patients that are unresectable. So we can offer them chemotherapy, and it would downsize the amount of tumor they have, and that means that we need to resect less liver. And that is pretty well applied to most any other strategy that we use. So we always give chemotherapy, and we have, I'm not going to go through all the details of the chemotherapy, but we do have several different regimes and several different lines of chemotherapy that we can use. We have local ablation therapies. So this is where we can destroy a tumor, and most often we can destroy it percutaneously. In other words, you come in the morning, you go to the radiology suite, we use some imaging modality, whether it be ultrasound or CT scan, and we place the needle where we want it. And I'll show you a little more about exactly what that looks like. And we can pass a current through it and destroy the tumor. And that may allow us to do less surgery because if there's one small tumor that's outside our resection field, we can just destroy it this way. Then we can use the liver's ability to regenerate by applying a technique called portal vein embolization. And I'll show you what that means. But what essentially that does is it can move liver around. It can move liver from the right to the left, and usually right to left. We usually don't go the other way. And then we can also apply a staged resection strategy. And that what that means is, again, we're taking advantage of the liver's ability to regenerate. So if we remove a piece of liver and we close and we allow the patient to go back to daily life for 6 weeks or 8 weeks, the liver will then regenerate because we've taken a piece of it out. And then we can go back and finish removing the tumor because we now have more liver. It requires two operations, but sometimes that's the strategy that we need to do. And we can also, of course, increase the function of a piece of liver. So it's the same amount of liver, but there are strategies, anti-inflammatory strategies and nutritional strategies that we can try to increase the function per unit of liver. And I'm not going to talk about that anymore. It's not prime time yet. We are using it at the MUHC in a variety of ways, but it still needs a little bit of work before we apply it on a broad basis. So, local ablation. So in the caricature above here, you have it's a Levine needle that we can place by either ultrasound or CT scan. We can place it into the tumor. We can deploy this array of probes, and then we can pass a current through this, and then we burn the tumor. And we have certain measurements that we can make, temperature and resistance to the tissue, to see if it's actually dead or not. And we're very good at destroying tumors that are 2 centimeters or less. So it can be a very good sort of adjuvant strategy to a resection strategy, so we can render the patient tumor-free. And here you can see this is a CT scan, and you can see where the arrow is. There's the tumor. And this is a CT scan after it's been ablated, and you can see how it's now dark and it has no vascularity. So it's dead. portal vein embolization, so this is where I was talking about. We're moving liver from one area to another. So what we do here is, so this is an X-ray after we've injected dye into the portal, into the venous system of the liver. And we've drawn in the right and the left. And then on this panel here, we have put a catheter into the right portal vein, and we have put this medical-grade crazy glue into the venous system of that side, and now that occludes it from receiving any blood work, any blood supply. So what will happen is that this right side will atrophy, will decrease in size, and the left side will now increase in size. And so that way you can take out less liver and leave more liver behind. So I'm just going to take all these conversion strategies and apply them to one patient, a real patient. And I'll just go through it. So it's a stage resection. So we did two liver resections on this patient at different times. We used portal vein embolization to direct the liver regeneration where we wanted it to go. And we used chemotherapy to cover the patient, first of all, to downsize the tumor. And then during this process, so the tumors don't get out of control, we used chemotherapy to keep that at bay. Now, just schematically, if this is your whole liver with the segments that I had pointed out to you before, we initially, in this patient, we took out the left lateral segment, which is 2 and 3. You can see there. They're missing here. Then we did a portal vein embolization of the right liver. So that's the 4 segments here, 7, 8, 5, and 6. And you can see in this scheme here, the segments 4, A and B, have increased in size. Then we cut out the right liver. And then we're left with just segment 4. There's also segment 1 that you can't see. So there's 2 segments, in fact. And then it hypertrophies even further. So the actual case, did I not have the scans? Oh, the scans are here. So this was this particular person was a 44-year-old female. And she presented to us with very extensive colon cancer, liver metastasis bilaterally. She got 3 or 4 months of chemo, and actually she was among the first to get the newer chemo, which was a renal TCAN, so FOLFIRI, which was in the early 2000s. That's when it came to Montreal. Then after that, we got a CT scan that revealed that maybe we could do the stage approach. We did some PET scans, but I'll skip some of those steps. We resected the left side of the liver, as I denoted on the diagram. We then did portal vein embolizations for the right, repeated the scan. We were happy with that, and we did a right liver resection, and we left her with segment 1 and segment 4. And the fact is that she's remained disease-free for many, many years. She's in the teens now. She's like 14 years out. Roughly 14 years. It was early 2000s. And you can see here, these sets of scans here are after chemotherapy. So she had a lot more disease before. So everything shrunk down. Even this big tumor here on the left side, it was way larger than that. And you can see that she has kind of tumor on most every segment of the liver, except segment 1. So that's what we started with. We then removed the left side of tumors, and in this image, I'd also done a portal vein embolization, so you can see that the middle of the liver has grown substantially. Then we cut out the right, and we're left with segment 4. That's what you see. So we kind of tricked segment 4 into expanding enormously, maybe 5 times its size initially, and she's disease-free long-term. So we've repeated that many times. We published our series of stage resections a little while ago, and we looked at the overall 5-year survival of these patients, and it's 42%, if you manage to complete the stage resections, which is the same as I showed you in the patients that had unilateral disease and underwent only one liver resection in the series that we show. So it's a very unique situation that we're able to do this in this particular. You cannot do this in most other tumors with it metastasized to the liver. So conversion strategies can add years of survival to patients with advanced colon cancer, liver metastasis. I guess that's the take-home message. So these conversion strategies add another 15% of patients to our already 20% of the patients that are initially resectable and seem to get the same benefit from the resection. And then there are several lines of chemotherapy that we have. In fact, we have up to four lines of chemotherapy for patients that we've developed since the 1990s. And we have been able, in patients that we cannot resect, to increase their median overall survival from 11 months to 28 months. And some of the recent literature suggests maybe more, 30 or 33 months, depending on what you read. And then when systemic therapy fails, we do have some local regional type therapy, and we can try to use the hepatic artery to provide these therapies directly into the tumor. Now, as we said, there are two blood supplies to the liver. So there's the portal vein and there's the artery, the hepatic artery. So the portal vein, in fact, provides 80% of the liver, 80% of the blood supply to the liver, and it feeds the parenchyma of the liver, so the actual liver itself, whereas the hepatic artery primarily feeds what we call the bile ducts, or the biliary system, where the little ducts that take the bile from the liver and put it into your intestine for digestion and so on. But also what we find is that the hepatic artery is the primary vascularity of tumors. So not to say that the portal vein doesn't have anything to do with it, but the hepatic artery is the primary is the primary vessel that feeds these tumors. Therefore, it provides an opportunity where you can selectively either put chemotherapy or beads that contain chemotherapy directly into the tumor, or beads that contain radioisotopes so that you can internally irradiate the tumors. Doesn't matter, whatever you decide to use. I mean, we use them for different reasons, and I'm not going to go into that. But we use these these approaches. And the way that we can do this is that, you know, we either can go to the femoral artery, that's the big artery in your leg, and nowadays, I'm seeing more of it, we can go through the artery in the arm, the brachial arm artery. We can put a catheter in that, and then go up the iliacs in the aorta and then come out what we call the celiac trunk here. I don't know if you could see it on, or maybe I should do this here. So that's the celiac trunk. And then you can actually feed this catheter into the hepatic artery and pretty well selectively pick out the tumor. And then you can put in what you want. You can put in from bland beads, microspheres that can block the blood supply to the tumor, which will cause some necrosis and downsize the tumor. You can put in chemotherapy directly into it. You can put beads that contain chemotherapy so they get stuck, lodged into the tumor, and then release the chemotherapy. Or you can put radioisotopes. It's called radioembolization. And it really is for a select group of patients. It's not for everybody. I mean, it has to be liver-dominated disease, and there are other things that have to fall into place. But it is available at the MUHC, all the forms that I just talked about. And it's something that can be done, you know, if other chemotherapy, systemic chemotherapies are not working. But this is not something that you would use up front. You would need to put it in a whole treatment package with the systemic therapy. And just briefly, you know, the whole world is, as Marag Park was saying, the whole world is moving towards precision care, personalized care, and I think you'll hear more about it tonight. We are Some of the work that we've been doing in the last 5 years is to identify tumors that will respond to drugs that target the blood vessels of that tumor. So the what most people would think happens with a tumor is that it creates new blood vessels when it grows. What we have found is that not all tumors do that. Some tumors actually co-opt existing mature blood vessels, and that these agents that we have been using to block new blood vessels growing have not been as useful, and the clinical outcomes have not been as good as we anticipated. And we think that this is why. So we can actually select out patients that can be treated with anti-angiogenic therapy more effectively by looking at this. If we look at these patients, we actually did this study with another group in London, England, and this is their series of patients. The patients that responded the best in the blue are patients that that had tumors that were getting their blood supply from developing new blood vessels, and the ones that were co-opting in the red didn't do as well. And our series kind of validated that series. Again, the blues are doing better, and the reds are doing less better when you give them anti-angiogenics because they're not growing new blood vessels, so we're targeting something that's not happening. And even more important than what's happening to the tumor itself, whether it's responding and tumor cells are dying, is the survival of the patients. So you can see if you give anti-angiogenics in this panel on the, I guess, on your left, you can see the blue have a close to a 50% 5-year survival when they're given an anti-angiogenic, whereas the ones that are co-opting only have an 18% 5-year survival. If you remove that drug from their therapy and then you cut out the tumors, and that would be the panel on your right, you see that the curves, one curve moves up and one curve moves down. So the beneficial effect to the tumors that were angiogenic is gone, and it seems to be that there may be a little detrimental effect on the tumors that were co-opting. So we're now trying to figure out ways to identify these patients because it would be most effective in patients that are unresectable, which is the majority of our patients, unfortunately. So we're using imaging to try to identify who's angiogenic and who's not, and also some blood markers, and we're moving towards developing sort of a algorithm that will help us identify each patient so that we can use the therapies appropriately. So conversion strategies increase the number of patients that we can resect, and we have a lot of hope for the histological growth patterns into identifying the appropriate patients for the appropriate treatment. And we need to identify now molecular mechanisms that this sort of new form of how tumors obtain vascularity through co-option so that we can figure out other types of medications that will target their mechanisms. And this is just... we have a yearly hepatobiliary symposium, and it just takes a lot of people to do this. It takes surgeons, our fellows who train with us, oncologists, our nurses, anesthesia, and our research group. A lot of the work that we're doing at the end here is through the MUHC Liver Disease Biobank, and again, banking is important. I want to reinforce that, as Morag was saying. Thank you very much.
So you're on immunotherapy now.
So when you refer to chemo,
most all targeted therapies and cytotoxic therapies, which regular chemo. The immunotherapy I didn't address.
Okay.
Right now, it seems to work in a very small group of colorectal cancer liver metastasis patients who have microsatellite instability. But there are trials ongoing now for everybody, for all types of colon cancer liver metastasis, and we've yet to see, what the outcome of that is yet.
So thank you, Peter. We also have a second patient, who is a scientist here at the Goodman Cancer Center, Dana Sofia Avizones. Dana was originally from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and she received her PhD in chemical physics from the University of California in San Diego. Following her PhD, she went to UCSF, the University of California, San Francisco, for a postdoctoral training in the Department of Pharmacology. Then she did a second postdoc at UC Berkeley, where she was an LSRF Merck Fellow. During her second postdoc, she was diagnosed at the age of 34 with cancer. After her fellowship and after her cancer treatments, she went to work for a large company called Varian, specializing in instruments such as NMR, and she was an application chemist there. Then she became very interested in metabolomics. So you've heard about metabolism. So metabolomics are the small molecules in your metabolism that we can use to trace disease and evolution of cancer. And she's been here at the Cancer Center for a number of years, 7 years. But she's been cancer-free for 19 years. So Dana, come and tell us your story.
I don't know. We'll see how it goes. I tend to pace a lot, so if you can't hear me, please just say something. So I had been complaining to my doctors in San Francisco for a number of years about digestive problems. And I finally had a new primary care physician, or a new family doctor, as you would call it here, who said, well, why don't we just, have a look? And the night before I went in for my colonoscopy, I sat down and I made a list of everything that it could be. And cancer was on the bottom. So diagnosis, it made sense. And I know that sounds kind of strange. Yeah, it was shocking, but at the same time, I'm a scientist. I understand that cells are always dividing, and there's the chance that things can go wrong. In this case, it made sense. I was kind of an oddball because I had two primary cancers. At least that's how it was described. I had a colon cancer, and I also had rectal cancer. So, one just wasn't enough for me. So what I did, the first thing that I did, is I went back over the bridge from Berkeley, and I got some books. And I realized that I tried to learn everything I could learn. As you've heard, my degree's in chemical physics. It's not in biology. It's not in cancer biology, but I'm capable of learning. So I read papers, I read these books, and I learned that there's a really big gap between what we're doing in the lab and what's happening in the clinic. And this really kind of struck me hard, because I was working in a laboratory where we looked at molecular mechanisms of cancer and transcription and all of these sort of things. But then what was happening in the clinic, to me, from my perspective, was almost barbaric. We're poisoning people. We're poisoning ourselves, as Nicole said. It's one thing to read about it, and it's like, oh, there's this new drug, that new drug. It's another thing to have that drug infused into your body. people look at you strange. You know, your hair is falling out. You have tubing coming out of your arms. But you get through it. So the other thing that I think that I might have done a little bit differently is that I didn't just take what my doctors told me I had to do. And, you know, I mean, this may be coming from my childhood that, you know, Mom would say, it's time to come in from the outside, you know, it's time to stop playing, and I'd have to have a good reason why. So there you go. I continued that, and I really considered it a collaboration with my caregivers. I asked them a lot of questions. I probably made them a little bit nuts. I also realized that I was not happy with the follow-up that the hospitals were providing. And I designed my own follow-up with my surgeon and her two residents. So I took it a little bit further, and it, I think, became their follow-up procedure from then on, because my surgeon went on to argue that the follow-up procedure we designed was much better than what they had in place. 6 months into everything, and there's a few things that happened. So at my resection, where they removed everything, because the rectal cancer, which was a stage 2 cancer, was in an area that was hard to get to, the resection was difficult. The colon cancer, which was stage 3, positive lymph node, so I'm heading into a bad area. That one came out pretty easily, but it was not good news. While I was recovering and I started eating, the resection didn't hold. So I went into sepsis, which, as we've heard about, maybe you know, back then I thought, well, that was a really awful thing to experience, but maybe it's something that saved my life, because it really activated my immune system. And we're hearing a lot about that. So, you know, it's kind of a mixed thing. But one of the things that my surgeon wanted to do, because I was always pushing her, and she pushed back. And after 6 months, there was a shadow on my liver. And I had a biopsy, and it just turned out to be a herniated bile duct. So I was really, thank God. But my surgeon was not convinced that, you know, let's be super careful about this. And she learned about a new technique called FDG PET scanning, which is what started my inspiration in moving towards learning about cancer and metabolism. So FDG is a modified, it's a fluorinated glucose molecule. And what happens is that your cells take up this molecule, just like they would take up sugar, but they can't metabolize it. They metabolize it to a particular point. Now, the bizarre thing is that a lot of different types of cancers hang on to that sugar, and they don't release it and excrete it, so eventually you urine, it comes out in your bladder, you pee, and it goes away. But for some reason, the cancer cells or the tumors hang on to this fluorinated glucose. And it's one of the primary imaging techniques used now to look for metastatic disease. And there's all kinds of other compounds that are also potentially metabolic compounds. So I thought, wow, that's really interesting. That's really, really interesting that there's a metabolic difference between healthy cells and cancer cells. Being in an instruments company, I then pushed the company to send me to a meeting, the first meeting of the Metabolomics Society, which also happened to be in Japan, and I love Japan. I got to travel there quite a bit as an applications chemist. So it was in a beautiful town called Tsuruoka, and the Japanese government had really invested heavily into looking at metabolomics. They were more interested in food science, and they were looking at rice and fungal diseases in rice. But the same sort of technology can be applied in looking at tissues, looking at healthy tissues versus cancerous tissues. So anyways, I started learning more, and I started pushing my company more, that this is an area that we need to be players in. And I started collaborating with my neighbors. So I started working with a group at UCSF, John Kurhanowitz's group. They're still there. They're primarily interested in doing better biopsies in prostates, as opposed to the poke at it Swiss cheese approach. They want to use magnetic resonance imaging in order to decide the best place to take a little bit of tissue out. So I was working with them on that and getting really interested. I helped design some of the instrumentation that they used and implemented that with engineers at the company that I worked at. But the thing that's really amazing, if you can see it, it's a little bit subtle, but on these are biopsy samples from a prostate. And you can see at the bottom here we have healthy glandular tissue, we have healthy stromal tissue, and we have the cancer. But what was amazing to me is that here we have lactate, which is a common metabolite. It's a metabolite that you make when you're digesting sugars. We see differences in alanine. We see differences in the phosphocholines. So now they're using these sort of markers, and they're doing what they call a magnetic resonance, MRS, magnetic resonance spectroscopy, on these patients, and they're guiding where they're going to take tissues from. So you also have a better chance of grabbing some of the bad tissue and having a better look at it. The technology we developed was also non-destructive. So the same tissue could be used for other diagnostic tests. So as you can tell, I spent some time, 10 years, developing an interest in this, and you kind of outgrow things, right? So I decided that this is an area that I really want to dedicate myself to and see if I can help researchers expand what they know about cancer. And so this is the lab here. I'm happy to give you guys tours. We're very proud of it. So we're a small facility, but we have all of the technology. We like measuring things, and we work very, very closely with our clinician scientists and scientists here in Montreal and actually around the world in trying to understand cancer as a metabolic disease. So the facility is doing really well. I believe that we're really making a difference in understanding how cancer can gather all of the fuel it needs for these cells to divide and to grow. And we're trying to find, as my colleague Rusty Jones would say, the Achilles heel of cancer as far as metabolism goes. So we have had, since we started the facility, over 60 high-impact papers. They're very highly cited, which means people are actually reading them. We have an excellent team that's dedicated. They work really, really hard within the facility. We train students to also do their own analyses. And we're also expanding the lab so we can cover a larger array of metabolites. We're actually looking into covering more lipids. And I hope that along with the clinicians and the scientists here at the GCRC and their collaborators, that bringing in some chemistry will actually really help make a difference.
So thank you, Dana. George, I don't know which one is yours. So our next speaker is also a clinician, George Zogopoulos, who's Associate Professor of Surgery, He's attending surgeon also in the same unit of hepatopancreatobiliary, and he added abdominal organ transplant surgery at the Royal Victoria Hospital at the Glen Yards. He's a scientist with the Research Institute of the McGill University Health Center and the Goodman Cancer Research Center of McGill University. George trained here at McGill and also in Toronto, where he was involved doing a postdoctoral fellow. His research training here at McGill was in obtained a PhD in experimental medicine. He studied regulatory mechanisms of a gene responsible for human growth. And in Toronto, his research training during his residency, he enrolled in surgeon scientist program at the university there. So he came back to Montreal. He's been in Montreal for 6 years, I think, right? 5-6 years. And it's a pleasure to welcome you to talk about pancreatic cancer.
Okay. So can everyone hear me in the back? Yes. We'll see how many slides we get through. Probably not all. And the intention is not to get through all slides. The intention is to focus on that first couple of words here. Well, the first word, which is progress and hope. So last weekend I was on call for liver transplant, and I had a phone call from Quebec Transplant. And the coordinator said, are you interested in a liver from a patient, from a donor, who's HIV positive? I said, absolutely. That disease has not been cured, but that disease has been made into a chronic disease. So 28 years ago, when my family first dealt with HIV, I didn't think that we would be transplanting organs from HIV positive patients. So I think we should keep that in mind as we tackle this problem called pancreatic cancer. So we have made progress in pancreas cancer over the years, and I will go through the slides, and I think that's the message I want to leave you with and leave you with some hope. I don't think that we need to conquer cancer by eliminating it completely. I don't think it is possible to do that, and I'll show you some evidence for why that is. I think what we could achieve is to cure cancers that are more, pancreatic cancers that are more favorable, and I use the word cancers because I think it's more than one disease, and perhaps make the ones that are not curable into chronic disease, like diabetes. So the pancreas is probably unhappy with us because we ignored it. We placed it, or Mother Nature placed it, how do I point, Morag? Placed it sort of here, deep in the back, unlike the liver, in a very prominent position, where it gets a lot of attention. The liver is a very intelligent organ. It's the most intelligent organ, and it's actually my favorite organ. But I'm mostly challenged by the pancreas. The pancreas sits back here, does its own thing, you know, earned a Canadian a Nobel Prize many years ago. And multiple Canadians, including somebody from McGill, this very cancer center, and sort of sits there and does its thing. And eventually, unfortunately, sometimes a tumor grows and it's silent up until it's potentially late in the game where it presents with advanced disease. So there are two types of pancreatic cancers. There are more than two types, but the two types that most of us hear of are the ones that Bill Gates had, his competitor Steve Jobs, and it was a neuroendocrine tumor. We could edit that from the recording. The neuroendocrine tumor type, and that's it may be a Freudian slip, Peter. So that represents about 10% of neuroendocrine tumors, and those are the types of tumors that
quite often are more chronic in nature. So they have a favorable evolution, most of them, and they could patients live a very long time with most of the subtypes here. Pancreatic adenocarcinoma is the disease we're talking about today, and it arises from the part of the pancreas that controls not the endocrine function, not the sugar control of the body, but the digestive part of the body. And it most of them arise from what's called the ductal system, the ductal cells. So what are the symptoms? Most of you have probably heard about painless jaundice. It starts off with pale stools, dark urine, your eyes get yellow, or the patient's eyes get yellow. They get itchy. They get yellow skin, and they end up in an emergency room, perhaps the Montreal General emergency room. And that triggers a CT scan, and then there's a mass there, and the process begins. Loss of appetite. So many of these patients come to the office saying, you know, for the last few months I felt fatigue, general malaise, I've lost weight, I'm not intending to lose weight, and, you know, I've just been feeling unwell. And I've seen my family doctor, and my family doctor gave me Pantelock because I had some reflux. And, you know, it's easy to go back, and hindsight's 20/20. It is a very difficult diagnosis to make. And that's the reason I put that cartoon initially up, showing where the pancreas is located. It's hidden. It's not an easy diagnosis to make. So the family physicians do a good job. It's just a very difficult diagnosis to make. We cannot put everybody through a CT scan or an MRI. It makes no sense because there's no evidence to show that it will save lives in the end. Diabetes is sometimes associated. So sometimes we see that patients come to the office and say, well, you know, within the last year, I've been told I've had a new diagnosis of diabetes. So that can be associated with it. By no means should you ask your family doctor to give you a CT scan if you're just recently diagnosed with diabetes. There's some questions to be asked, and there are reasons to consider imaging a patient with a new diagnosis of diabetes, but it can be associated. The association is not particularly strong, but there is some association. The one diagnosis that I think needs, and Peter would agree, needs follow-up is the diagnosis of pancreatitis, particularly if that diagnosis is not explained. So if you walk into the Royal Victoria Hospital emergency department and you're told you have pancreatitis, and there's no underlying cause for this pancreatitis. It's not stones, you're not a heavy drinker, you haven't been bitten by a scorpion, and those who are in medicine would know why I'm referencing to that. It's a very rare cause of pancreatitis. If there's not a cause of pancreatitis and there's inflammation there, you need to see Peter, myself, or one of the surgeons that deals with this disease and have some sort of imaging at a 3-month interval from diagnosis to make sure there's not a tumor hiding under there. You know, every year we diagnose a few of these cases where the presentation was pancreatitis. And, you know, maybe if the diagnosis was made a little earlier and we tackled this when the inflammation settled down, perhaps the prognosis would have been better. Pain is a late symptom. Quite often, when pain presents, unless it's in the context of pancreatitis, it's a late symptom. Upper mid back pain up here usually signifies that the nerves are involved and the disease is locally advanced. So there's hope, but we have to do better because this disease will surpass. Where's breast? Here's breast. Breast is on the decline because Morag has done such a great job and others. Colon and rectum is on the decline as well because we've done a better job. Maybe not. It may just be easier diseases to tackle. Pancreas cancer is on the rise, and by 2020, it's projected to be the second leading cause of cancer death in North America and in the Western world. In Canada, today, it's the fourth leading cause of cancer death. It's still a fairly rare disease. There are about 5,200 new diagnoses in Canada per year, or projected in 2016. Divide that according to the population distribution across the provinces, and you get about 1,500 or so in Quebec. If you look at the number of deaths, that's discouraging, and you're thinking, well, he's saying there's progress, but the number of deaths pretty much equals the number of new diagnoses. But that gap is widening. When I went to residency, I can't think far back to medical school, but at least residency, we talked about 2 to 3% five-year survival. So if we're talking about 8%, we've made some, although small, we've made some progress over the last few years, and I'll tell you why. It still remains, though, the cancer with the highest mortality among all cancers, as cited by the Canadian cancer statistics last year. So has there been progress? I've answered that question. The answer is yes. How have we made progress? Well, the first thing we've done is we've learned how to do surgery well. We've centralized it. We put it into places like the McGill University Health Center, where we have built teams, or Peter and company built teams and recruited some of us there to be part of those teams, where it's not just a surgeon, it's the entire team around the surgeon and the patient. I should say around the patient rather than the surgeon that looks after the patient. So if there's a problem after surgery, that's quickly identified and it's properly managed and efficiently managed. And that will get you, and why is that important? It's not just important from reducing mortality. When they first described what's called the Whipple operation, it was done in two stages and eventually in one stage, and the mortality was 30%+. It's now 1 to 3%, and it should be 1 to 3%. If it's not, it means you're not being treated at the right place. So by putting and concentrating surgery in high-volume centers, developing care around it to deal with problems when problems arise, what we're achieving is not only, you know, doing surgery safely, but getting that patient on to the next stage of treatment, which is chemotherapy. Because what we've learned, and this came out through a trial in 2007, was published in 2007, called the CONCO trial, we learned that if we combine surgery with chemotherapy when we had the intent to cure, so patients that presented with early enough disease where cure was potentially a possibility, they would need to go on to chemotherapy. So if you run into complications, sepsis is a bad thing for cancer more often than not, you don't end up going to chemotherapy early enough and the disease ends up propagating. So by doing surgery safely, we get the patient to chemotherapy, and we know that combining chemotherapy with surgery gives us the best chance of winning this cancer and for a cure. Initially, when the trial was published, it was said that it prolongs disease-free survival. So in cancer outcomes, we talk about disease-free survival, so you take the tumor out. How long does the patient live without having a recurrence of the cancer? So that was shown initially in 2007, and after later on, when they did the full follow-up after 10 years or so, they showed that there was a survival advantage in patients that got chemotherapy after surgery. So that is a standard of care. We've made some more progress, and we've changed our treatments now at the MUHC, and we've taken advantage of what's called the SPAC-4 trial, which combines gemcitabine with the old colon cancer drug, which is 5-FU, and patients get 6 months of that treatment after surgery. So surgery is safe, so we've done that, and we've made some advances in treating patients that present with early enough disease where the disease is potentially curable. But really, I think where you're seeing the biggest impacts is our ability to treat advanced disease, and I think we're doing a lot better there. And that's been more recent. So here are some statistics that support that statement. So you will see in the 2016 Canadian cancer statistics, there's been a decrease in mortality in both males and females between 2003 and 2012. I don't think that decrease in mortality is accounted by the newer forms of chemotherapy combinations that have made it into the market. I think that is accounted by safer surgery and giving perhaps patients chemotherapy after having a curative intent resection or surgery with the intent to cure. In the next decade, we'll see the impacts of the newer forms of chemotherapy. So this is where we were when I went to medical school, perhaps, or graduated medical school, and this is where we're at now. So I think we've made some progresses here in terms of early stage 1 and 2 in the curative intent range, but I think what we're seeing is greater progress in the later stages, stage 3, which is a locally advanced form of pancreatic cancer, and stage 4. And you could see that we're pushing what's called median survival. It's still terrible. You know, 16 and 17, 18 months of median survival is not great, but it is significantly better than where we were earlier with stage 3, and we've made progress with stage 4 as well. And these are averages. There are patients that do well and some that do better, don't do as well. And where are, you know, and these advances have come with newer forms of chemotherapy. So before showing you that, this sort of summarizes, you know, how we think about managing a patient with pancreatic cancer. So this is what I teach the residents and fellows. I said, forget about stage, think about the patient, and then put stage, the patient's stage, in sort of your treatment plan for the patient. So we all want to be here. We want to be at this end of the spectrum. This end of the spectrum, our goal is cure. We want to cure this patient of their disease. That is where we want to be. And that has to do with, you know, what is the patient's overall performance? You know, has the patient lost 80 pounds and they're very weak? Even if they have an early tumor, most of the time they don't, but even if they have an early tumor, they can't be resected, they can't be operated on, or do they have other diseases that prevent surgery? So if they don't have a good performance or have other diseases that contribute to their overall performance, then we cannot aim for a curative approach, despite the fact that they may be early stage. But assuming the patient is diagnosed with an early stage operable tumor, our intent is cure. And what we do there is surgery. We try to take out the tumor. We give them chemotherapy to prevent recurrence. And the reason that's important is because pancreas cancer, perhaps unlike some of the other cancers, when it presents, we think there is metastatic disease. That metastatic disease, we call it systemic disease. By that we mean that there's probably metastatic disease. There are cells that have spread and seeded somewhere. They're not visible. So therefore, we give the patient the benefit of the doubt, and we go ahead, take out the tumor, give them chemotherapy, and hope that the chemotherapy will tackle and cure the disease. Patient may present what's called with locally advanced pancreas cancer, and then we give something called neoadjuvant. Neoadjuvant comes from the word neo, which is Greek, before adjuvant therapy. So we give chemotherapy, and it's really what I call a trial of life. So we see what the evolution of the tumor is on chemotherapy. If the patient does well, both with respect to their performance and with respect to the evolution of the tumor, there's no evidence of spread, then maybe we'll push towards this side of this spectrum and go ahead with surgery. Even if they have locally advanced disease that involves vessels, then we need to reconstruct them. So that's a technical consideration. What's important is how the disease behaves more than the technical considerations. Most of us could figure out how to manage the technical challenges, but it's a disease that we have a hard time managing. So if the disease is advanced towards stage 3 and 4, then our goals are to try to convert this to a chronic illness, control the disease, chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is what we know works. We know that this is a systemic problem, we said. So trying to give regional therapy like Peter's showed for a systemic problem would not work. Those circumstances are different than this disease. And finally, you know, if the disease progresses or the patient weakens, we have to think about comfort measures. Supportive care. And I've put supportive care across the entire, you know, spectrum of disease because I think that's important. It's important the patient has a good exercise program, spiritual guidance if they wish to have that at the time of diagnosis. Nutrition. I mean, that will make them do well with help them do well with surgery as well as with their chemotherapy. So clinical trial in this disease is important. I think, you know, at every stage, If there's the opportunity for clinical trial should be considered. When you have a disease that is so deadly, I hate to use that word, but it's true, and there's opportunity for clinical trial, that should be considered, including, you know, early stage curative disease. So when we I've heard a lot about introducing innovation, and I think that you know warrants a little bit of discussion. You know, in Western medicine, innovation is introduced by clinical trial. We'd like to have phase 3 level clinical trial data before we introduce a new drug, before we introduce new therapy. Sometimes that's not possible, especially as we're moving towards precision medicine, where we're looking at targeted therapies and we're selecting very small groups of cancers. We're taking a bit, you know, an umbrella like pancreatic cancer, and we're subdividing the little subtypes. It may be hard to get enough people to do a what's called a phase 3 randomized trial. So we'll have to rethink that. We have to think about our local healthcare resources in implementing it. You know, how do we implement it efficiently? So that's important. Industry has goals that may not necessarily converge with our goals. Our goals as patients and our goals as physicians. So we've seen a lot of, and I'll show you a couple of examples, we've seen a lot of, you know, ablative technology. So when RFA, radiofrequency ablation, came into the market for treating liver tumors, it did not come into the market through proper phase 3 clinical trials. It came based on experiences and people putting these experiences forward. And we're seeing some challenges there with pancreas cancer. And we just have to we have to be careful and make sure that we're not harming. So biology is king. You'll hear us say that a lot. It's really what will dictate the evolution of the disease. And at the end of the day, the patient must have a benefit. And we have to think about the patient's quality of life and whether this will have an impact on survival before we introduce it. So quickly, stage 4 disease, we've made progress, okay? It's not terrific progress, but we've made progress. We've gone from, you know, we have newer, you know, you guys have heard of FOLFIRINOX and gemcitabine with Abraxane, and these combination therapies have increased survival from 6 months to 12 months and more. And that's what our local institutional data is as well. The challenge is locally advanced pancreas cancer and how do we manage it? And that definition varies depending on the review article you read, perhaps even the surgeon you encounter. I've developed an interest in this, because when I first arrived here, for some reason, most of the referrals that I had were with locally advanced pancreas cancer. Locally advanced pancreas cancer and stage 3 pancreas cancer are somewhat different. They both can't quite see the... So they're both locally advanced. You could have a tumor here that is involving these main vessels in the middle of the abdomen. If it involves the artery, it's stage 3 by definition. If it just involves the vein there, the blue vein there, it could be referred to as locally advanced. They possess technical problems. So, you know, in the sense that if they're involving the vessels, then you have to reconstruct the vessels if you remove the tumor. But more importantly, what involvement of the vessel signifies is it's probably a surrogate for more advanced disease than just locally advanced disease. So if they've attacked the artery, the nerves that travel behind the artery are attacked. That's why patients get pain. And the lymphatics that are there are also attacked. And if the lymphatics are attacked, there's probably systemic disease. So if we look at our own institutional experience, and this is over the last 4 to 5 years where we've introduced modern chemotherapy. It's a very complicated slide, and I can't seem to... Here we go. So these are patients that presented with this line here. This is time in days, and this is percentage of patient survival. And this line here, this purple line, represents patients that presented with stage 1 and stage 2 disease, and they do the best as one would expect. This line here represents patients that presented with locally advanced or stage 3 pancreas cancer. They underwent chemotherapy and they were watched. They then had radiation therapy if they did well on chemotherapy, and they went ahead and they had curative intent resection, which may or may not have involved reconstructing an artery. And what we could see that these patients, called PAIR for pancreatectomy with on-block arterial resection, do as well as the patients that had no vascular resection, and probably because we left behind the patients that progressed on chemotherapy were not offered surgery. So we saved those patients the burden of surgery and the tragedy that can come with surgery. These patients here, upfront resection, presented with a locally advanced pancreas cancer that involved a vein, and they went and had surgery because we knew that patients with locally advanced pancreas cancer just involved a vein had the same outcome if you resected the tumor as patients that did not have a vein involved. And that was based on older data where patients were only treated with gemcitabine, older chemotherapy. But now we have newer chemotherapy, and what we're seeing is that the newer chemotherapy is having an impact, because the patients that got chemotherapy alone versus the patients that got upfront resection seem to be doing the same. So we have to consider this as we move forward, because chemotherapy is much stronger. So I'm going to advance. I didn't get my full 15 minutes, perhaps, but I'm gonna show two more slides, and I'm gonna tell you how we've tackled it. I mean, I think the message I wanted to get across is that has been put forward. But I think what I want to show is this slide here. And when I arrived in Montreal, we put together what's called a registry. It's a patient registry. It now includes 700 patients over 5.5 years. And we built this registry not just collecting specimens, but like Morag has done with their registry and Peter has done with his, collecting a knowledge bank so that we could understand the disease better. We're moving away from that. And, you know, we're building on that. And what we're building on is creating these registries prospectively towards the era of precision medicine. And so the problem with these registries is, yes, we're collecting the biospecimens, we're collecting data, but all of it is being done in a retrospective way, in the sense that we're going back to the charts and seeing how patients did. What we'd like to do is have a diagnosis of pancreas cancer, have a biopsy, make sure we understand what chemotherapy the patient is on, and follow them during their journey with the cancer diagnosis and see how they do. So this is a COMPASS study. It's called COMPASS. It was developed in Toronto, and we're opening it up here as well. This is going to be funded by Pancreatic Cancer Canada. And what it does is patients that present with stage 4 plus or minus stage 3 disease, that we can obtain a radiological biopsy, go ahead and have a radiological biopsy. And then we move forward and we sequence their entire tumor DNA and RNA and try to put it into molecular signatures and identify targets that when their disease progresses, we could target. And here's an example of this. So we've done some pilot studies here, patients here at the MUHC. This is an example of a patient that has a mutation in this gene. This is a phenomenal story. This is a woman that presented with stage 4 disease 5 years ago. And she's one of these rare cases that had an absolute amazing response to FOLFIRINOX, and her disease went away. It recurred, and you know, we've sequenced her tumor, and we have found what we call an actionable mutation. And you know, this patient, if she was in a place where this phase 1 trial was available, she'd be a candidate for it. What we could do in the lab is test it. In any case, so that's where we're at in 2017. Thank you. Thank you.
Our next patient is Dr. Gordon Shore. Dr. Shore is a senior professor in the Department of Biochemistry. Actually, Dr. Shore was a professor when I joined McGill 30 years ago. I was not going to let that one pass. He was born a professor. He's also the director of the Laboratory of Therapeutic Developments, which was instituted a few years ago. He's a principal investigator at the Goodman Cancer Research Center. But Gordon has also a parallel life. And he's been serving as chief scientific officer of a company called Terilia Development, and also of another McGill spin-off, which is called Diazon Pharmaceuticals. He's a venture partner in Sanderling Ventures. And this all stems from the research he's done in his laboratory, where he's identified a number of targets working on cell survival and cell death, the balance between the two and how you tip from one to the other. He's established a very strong research program here at McGill, but also in these companies. And he's been an inspiration to all of us because he's essentially taught us how we go from the lab, the pipette, and the tubes to exploiting our new discoveries and trying to market these or bring them to fruition so they can serve as new therapies for patients. Gordon is a pancreatic cancer patient now. So he's going to talk to us about a different part of his life.
Thank you, Nicole. So it's late. Thank you for hanging in, and I'll try to be brief. So I think based on Nicole's introduction, you can well imagine that I've given a lot of presentations over my time. This one is pretty unusual, I have to say. And so what I decided to do was just to objectively describe the various stages that I've gone through following diagnosis with pancreatic cancer and the various treatments I've had, and then my response to all of that based on the, my knowledge as a research scientist in oncology. So if my wife Alexandra had her way, she would undoubtedly want me to talk a lot more about the so-called spiritual journey, for want of a better term. Suffice to say that every day is an absolute blessing, and it provides an opportunity to give. I have an amazing family whose support has been just incredibly important. So my journey as a cancer patient started just over 2 years ago. I had some weird symptomology, sort of suggestive of maybe a biliary obstruction. I was very busy at the time, not surprisingly. Kept putting off maybe looking after this. Thought about going to my family physician and then said, in fact, on the morning of March 5th, when I got up, I said, no, you know what, I'm going to head to the emergency of a really big, good teaching hospital, the Montreal General, and I'll have this thing looked at, and we'll check it out. So a young physician came in, and we had a conversation, and then that was followed by head of emergency medicine of the day, and he came in and said, I think we need to do a few tests. And so for the remainder of the day, I had a lot of blood work done, ultrasound, CT, MRI, a lot of discussions. And at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the head of ER medicine came out and said, sorry to let you know, but you have a pancreas tumor and you have a couple of lesions in your liver. Very sorry to pass this information on to you. And from my perspective, I was really hearing the lesions on the liver because that suggested metastatic pancreatic cancer. In other words, as you've heard, a very, very serious condition. So from there, I went to the ER desk, and they said, we're now going to move you to the Royal Vic, where you're going to be cared for. Here's a taxi chit. There's a taxi waiting outside. They're going to take you over to the Vic. So we really do have a complete healthcare system here. So, you know, I said, really, I think I can afford, I'll pay for my own. No, you're going to take the chit and head over to the Vic. Well, you realize they're going to stop at a bar on the way over to the Vic. No, you're not going to stop at a bar. You're going to go straight to the Vic. And so shortly after that, my wife Alexandra and I got off the elevator, and my friend and physician, Dr. Zagopoulos, was basically waiting outside the elevator. And he had reviewed the MRI images and felt pretty strongly that the lesions on the liver were probably benign hemangiomas, just based on his interpretation. And based on his review of the scans, thought that I might be a candidate for surgery. I have to say that I knew Dr. Zagopoulos as a friend and colleague at the research level, but I've come to know him as a physician, surgeon, and he really is an individual who really embodies the term physician. In other words, his number one priority is the welfare of his patients. And it's a very demanding position that he holds. And I think that for physician scientists, surgeon scientists who are on call basically 24/7 when they are on call, the demands are really extraordinary. And for those of us who know them only as research colleagues, I don't think we completely comprehend or appreciate the demands that are on their time. So their ability to take the knowledge that they have as physicians and understanding the biology through a hands-on approach to cancer and then be able to integrate that into a very demanding research program is incredibly important, and we can't do the basic research without the involvement of these dedicated physicians who work not only as researchers and physicians, but collaboratively with basic researchers in a highly cooperative, synergistic manner to try to make some sense and progress in this disease. So 3 weeks later, Dr. Zagopoulos performed surgery to remove my pancreas tumor. And that's not just plucking out a tumor mass. In this particular situation, it requires a complete reconstruction of the upper digestive tracts for a whole variety of reasons. A very complex, takes a lot of skill to execute this surgery successfully. I was in the operating room for about 11 hours with Dr. Zagopoulos, and he did an outstanding job. I recovered from this surgery very quickly and had no complications. And this was done at the Royal Victoria Hospital, probably one of the last surgeries that were done at the hospital 2 years ago. So from there, as Dr. Zagopoulos had indicated, surgery resection is typically followed by chemotherapy. And in my case, that involved a cocktail. Again, he referred to it FOLFIRINOX. It's just a cocktail of chemotherapies, a few cycles of FOLFIRINOX, and then followed by multiple cycles of gemcitabine. Now, in 2017, chemotherapy is not what medicine aspires to in terms of medical intervention in the treatment of cancer. It does not attack the underlying biology, the underlying genetic changes that are responsible for driving this disease. Nevertheless, today it is the only options that are realistically available. There are a large number of clinical trials, even in this adjuvant setting, many more in the metastatic setting. But the genetic changes that occur in pancreatic cancer are pretty profound, and I'll talk a little bit about that on the one hand, and very complex, multiple changes. It's not just a single gene aberration disease. This is a conflagrance of multiple changes that occur to drive this disease. So, as Nicole had indicated, chemotherapy is just poison. It's just kills rapidly dividing cells, both cancer and host cells. And what we're really after is, as I said, is to try to target the underlying biology. And Dr. Zagopoulos and I had this discussion during my chemotherapy, and that is trying to find that balance between, you know, objective benefit, maybe getting, you know, a month or two enhanced survival versus quality of life, a topic that Atul Gawande and his best-selling book, Being Mortal, talks about. It refers to medicine and what matters in the end. So as a patient, I think it's very important to try to find this balance between this type of adjuvant therapy and, you know, what objective benefit would be obtained, especially an individual who wants to stay busy and is very committed to doing what he does and wanted to build the ability to continue and to contribute. A very dear friend of mine overseas heads up clinical development in oncology at Bristol-Myers Squibb and was responsible for the clinical development and all the successful approvals for nivolumab, their immunotherapy, the PD-1 inhibitor. And I had a long conversation with him about the possibility of intervention via immunotherapy. And unfortunately, and I think this is the emerging experience, clinical experience, is that, again, for the complex genetic changes that occur with this disease and perhaps the surrounding environment, microenvironment of this disease, penetrating immunotherapy drugs is proving to be quite a challenge. So from there, it was tough. Lost over 50 pounds in weight after you go through that complex surgery and learning to live with an altered digestive system, and then putting on top of that chemotherapy. It is pretty tough challenge, but you get through it. You begin to feel better, and you know, things are actually pretty wonderful, all things considered. In the fall of last year, I developed diabetes, not surprisingly, since a large part of the pancreas has been removed. But that is very well managed by insulin and metformin. And then throughout the fall, last fall and into January, I'm being regularly monitored by primarily CT scan, biomarker, blood analysis. It was obvious that I was developing lung metastases, which thankfully are currently stable. And the lung is a metastatic site where things can actually move fairly slowly. And so Dr. Zagopoulos, my medical oncologist, Nathaniel Buganum, you know, we're in kind of constant discussions, and nothing special. This is what goes on with every one of their patients. But in my case, we decided to explore things a little bit more deeply. We decided to look at the sequence and the genomic alterations that might be associated with 350 genes that are typically associated with different types of cancers. It could be pancreatic cancer, it could be any cancer, because you might find a mutation that, you know, occurred in lymphoma that might provide an opportunity for novel treatment in pancreatic. This is the whole basis for genomic approaches, precision medicine, in terms of trying to develop novel treatments. And so we had this work done at Foundation One, a Roche diagnostics firm located in Boston. The results have come back, and they really do illustrate the problem with pancreatic cancer. I have an activating, and this is all possible because Dr. Zogopoulos biobanked my tumor, as he does with so many tumors, so that there are literally hundreds of tumors that are available for such sequence analysis. And although it may not benefit any one patient, collectively, this is going to be very important, and it's going to be very important for the future as we begin to be able to align treatment responses, potentially novel mutations that correlate with hopefully good responses. So KRAS is an activating mutation in the KRAS gene, which is quite typical of pancreatic. It's a very aggressive oncogenic driver. I have disabling mutations in TP53, SMAD4, got a BRCA2 mutation. This is not very good news. But what it does establish is that these are likely the genetic basis, the genetic drivers of my disease. And the problem has been, over the last 10, 15 years or so, that despite enormous worldwide effort at trying to develop novel therapies that tackle an activated KRAS or try to replace the P53 tumor suppressor, these biologies have just not fallen to be amenable to develop the kind of therapies that we would like to have. If we had a great therapy that targeted activated KRAS, I would stand a very, very strong chance of being fully cured. So there are, however, as a result of doing this analysis, some downstream opportunities. Downstream of the KRAS gene is a very complex pathway called the MAP kinase pathway, and there are currently some clinical trials ongoing with some new drugs that target not KRAS, but target some of the enzymes and some of the pathways immediately below KRAS. And so with my discussions with Dr. Zogopoulos, Dr. Buganim, we're probably going to take a look into when to potentially looking into those trials when at some time in the future, hopefully, I begin to progress. Certainly won't do it while I'm stable. It will be on a kind of a watch and observe status. I'll be finished in just a couple of minutes. So the hope in Dr. Zogopoulos' presentation comes obviously from research. This is 2017. We're not going to be treating pancreatic cancer in 2037 the way we're treating it in 2017. But, you know, the fruits of research take a long time to get to the clinic. And at the Goodman Cancer Research Center, there's an awful lot of really exciting stuff, research that is going on. I've made a list here of some of the investigators and some of the novel approaches that relate to pancreatic cancer. But this also goes on, as we heard, for breast, advanced breast, for lung cancer, for liver cancer, many of the challenging cancers that exist today. And so one of the things that we're really excited about at the Goodman is launching on a mission to begin to take a number of these exciting discoveries and, as Nicole had indicated, try to take them further toward the clinic so that we might see a benefit for patients. This is incredibly expensive research, but we have great teams at the Goodman. We're incredibly excited about some of the possibilities that exist. We're going to roll up our sleeves and work very hard at raising some really significant funds so that some of these projects that are, we believe, are near-term with respect to translating into a potential clinical benefit. We'll put a lot of energy behind trying to see whether we can explore those in the clinic. And personally and collectively, we're having an incredible amount of fun doing that. And I personally look forward to helping out to the extent that that I can. So thanks very much for your attention.
So if the speakers would like to step up to the podium. If you have questions, you can write them on your cue card. Before you leave, I want to remind you of a few things that will be happening in the next few weeks. And I lost my other presentation. So there is, on May the 2nd, here in this auditorium, a very special symposium, an evening like this, that's going to be held through collaborations with Pancreatic Cancer Canada. So we are bringing together with our colleagues from Toronto some of the most prestigious people in Canada, including George, including some of the other physicians who are treating patients with pancreatic cancer, to discuss the disease, the novelties. Some of the patients or the patient families will be there, so you're certainly invited to come. This is being promoted on our website, and you'll be receiving, as normally you do, the invites to register for this evening. On the May the 5th, there is an afternoon with a very special person that is actually being brought over from Boston from the Cole Foundation. And so this is a clinician who's had a lot of experience treating children who were diagnosed with various types of cancers but have grown to be older adolescents, and in some cases make it into adulthood. And so he will be discussing for a lay audience some of the research that he's done over the last 20 years relative to these patients and how they survive and why they survive and how they go through all this ordeal and the human beings that they become. So that's the second, May 2nd, May 5th. And the third event is the last public forum, which is on May 17th, all about melanoma. And again, we have a network of melanoma people who will be discussing some of the novelties. And this field is going so fast, we have trouble keeping up. So these are experts who will be here to tell you about this with patient contribution. So now, questions for our guests. Moran. Aromatase inhibitors have been given for 5 years. Do you agree 10 years would be better? P.S. Nicole stopped her Arimidex. Now, this is somebody who probably knows too much about me.
So basically, this is on a patient-by-patient basis, and this is something that should be discussed with your clinician. And since I'm not the clinician, this is not for me to really give my advice. But this, you should discuss this with your clinician and be part of the team, as we've heard. Clinicians are working with teams that can make decisions, and these decisions will be about you and your disease.
I guess George, maybe. How useful, or Peter as well, how useful is CA19-9 and CEA to diagnose cancer, and how high the levels have to be to indicate cancer?
So the biomarkers are of some value. I think if you have a very elevated CA19-9 and you present with a mass in the head of the pancreas, then we're quite worried. Sometimes the CA19-9 level is falsely elevated when the patient is jaundiced. So we have to wait for the jaundice to subside to know what the true reading is. The other caveat with CA19-9 is not everybody makes a CA19-9. So if you're Lewis antigen negative, you will not make it CA19-9 level. So it's got some value. In pancreatic cancer, CA is of little value. In colon cancer, it does have prognostic. Maybe we'll let Nicole answer that, or Peter.
Yeah, so is it working?
Yeah.
So CEA, the initial CEA reading has a prognostic value. If it's over 200, it's a bad prognostic sign. It's not the only prognostic sign, so it's part of a more of a scoring system, but on its own, it counts as a sort of bad point on the prognostic scale if it's over 200. If you don't have a high CA, it doesn't mean that you don't have colon cancer, so it's not diagnostic in that sense. And it's extremely useful to follow patients after you have treated them and rendered them disease-free, and you want to follow them to see if there's a recurrence.
Can you transplant the liver?
Yes, we can, but are you talking about for colorectal liver metastasis? I would assume, yeah. Yes, we can transplant a liver for many reasons, and for colon cancer liver metastasis, it's not a, it's out of the box, but there are a couple of groups in Europe that have done a series of patients with, certain selection criteria, and there does seem to be a benefit to it. The problem is that we do have a limitation in availability of organs, but there can be a consideration and within some sort of structured program where you can actually study the outcomes of performing these transplants in that type of patient.
Can you transplant the pancreas?
So just to pick up on that, liver transplantation for cancer exists for some select cancers. In general, the answer is no, outside a research protocol, and there is no research protocol for neither colorectal cancer or metastatic pancreas cancer to the liver, if that's the question. Could you transplant the pancreas? The answer is you can transplant the pancreas, but the same concept applies. You won't get rid of the problem. So by transplanting a pancreas, where we typically transplant the pancreas in the pelvis, we will not take out the pancreatic cancer. It won't eliminate the systemic disease, so it won't cure the disease. So the answer is no.
The indication for pancreas transplant is type 1 diabetes. So it's actually a totally different, you're solving a totally different problem.
Maybe for Dana and Gordon and myself, you all called chemo poison. How much do you believe it works?
I'm moving, talking, breathing. It worked.
So, chemotherapy has been the bedrock of cancer therapy for the last 50 years. And as we had indicated, we call it poisons because it really doesn't discriminate between normal host cells and cancer cells. Cancer cells, or at least certain cancer cells that are susceptible to chemotherapy, are rapidly dividing and therefore are more susceptible to these kinds of poisons. So they attack usually metabolic processes often associated with cell division. DNA replication, et cetera, so that the cancer cells are hopefully killed. The problem is that it carries a tremendous burden of toxicity for most patients, and remarkably, and we talk a lot about and the hope of cancer research, as I think we really emphasized, was to try to attack the underlying biology, the underlying causes of the diseases, because you have a much, much stronger opportunity for selectivity and potentially a cure. Having said that, there is obviously a remarkable role for chemotherapy in treatment. It is by far the most widely prescribed type of therapy in cancer treatment worldwide. And it's quite remarkable, actually, that there's been relatively little innovation over the last couple of decades, two or three decades, in terms of designing new types of chemotherapies that are maybe more selective, less toxicity, et cetera. But chemotherapy is going to be with us for a long time to come. There probably is room for better innovation. And the thought process as well is that for certain chemotherapies, the ability to combine those therapies with both targeted therapies, immunotherapies, et cetera, is going to be a room for a potential success as well. And we find this out only through, you know, really rigorous controlled clinical trials that provide the data over a large number of patients so that we can make rational decisions with respect to what works and what doesn't work.
You know, Nicole, if I could just add to that. So what we've seen with combination therapy, so what has given rise to combination therapies are failures of single agents. So if you have a bad problem and you can't attack it with a single agent, you start putting a bunch of drugs together. And that's what we've seen in colon cancer, and we've seen it in pancreas cancer as well. And that leads to a lot of toxicity. I mean, I think improvements will come as we understand the disease and the biology better.
So is metformin active or useful with pancreatic cancer or to prevent cancer?
I'll take the first crack, and then Dr. Zagopoulos will correct me. So metformin, the actual mechanism of action, not completely understood. It clearly functions on mitochondrial metabolism. But the retrospective studies in pancreatic cancer looked at a huge cohort of patients, and it was recognized that a subset that had diabetes that were on metformin as part of their care, their survival was actually pushed by 6 months, 8 months, something like that. But it was statistically real. And this probably circles back to the role of metformin in metabolism. And it's not completely understood, its mechanism, I said, but its effects. But I think that there's a strong belief amongst a lot of clinicians and scientists that there is some sort of metabolic benefit that is going on, particularly with respect to pancreatic cancer, because there the underlying metabolism may be more susceptible to metformin treatment. My physicians are very happy that I'm on metformin.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it's quite intriguing. It's not level one evidence, but the evidence that we do have is encouraging. Dr. Morris at the MEHC is another chronologist that has an interest in this and will put patients on metformin, and I quite like that, actually.
So more questions. Are diabetics prone to pancreatic cancer?
So the answer is no. The short answer is no. So type 1 diabetics, there hasn't been an association with it. There is a link between diabetes and pancreas cancer. That link, that association is not strong. But there is an association.
Gordon told us about his lung metastasis, but which other organs may be targets of metastasis for pancreatic?
So the most common organ